From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. The Hammond organ of Booker T. Jones gave a soulful groove to the 60s hits of Booker T. and the MGs. With a local concert coming up, it's Booker T. Jones and his timeless music today on Insight. So today, two memorable winners of the TV show The Apprentice join us. Sean Yazbek and Randall Pinkett still work for Donald Trump. Duties include pitching the Trump Institute, which offers seminars in our area next week. Plus, a local food blogger is getting national buzz. You'll meet writer Elise Bauer. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a popular food blogger who lives in Carmichael was recently written about in the Wall Street Journal because of her growing influence. Elise Bauer will join us. Also, Green Onions is one of the timeless songs of soul and rock music. The leader of the band that created Green Onions and other classics plays our area this weekend. It's a conversation with Booker T. Jones later on Insight. First, probably the two most memorable winners of The Apprentice, the Donald Trump TV show, were Sean Yazbek, the Englishman from Season 5, and Dr. Randall Pinkett, the man with 5 degrees from Season 4. They still work for Donald Trump, the spokesman for the Trump Institute, which offers business seminars. The Trump Institute visits Stockton and Sacramento over the next few days. Joining us are Messrs. Yazbek and Pinkett. Sean, Randall, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here with Sean.
Sean, what did you make of Donald Trump before you met him, and how did that change as you got to know him?
Well, I mean, coming from England, he's an icon over there. I mean, the name Trump is an international brand, so his reputation obviously precedes him. I'll be honest with you, a little bit intimidated by him before, you know, really got to know him. But once you start working in the organization, you adapt to his style of leadership. It's no nonsense. He gets straight to the point. He tells you what he wants. He tells you what he doesn't want. And you just get used to it. You actually learn from him.
And Randall, what about you? Same question. What did you expect of Trump, and what did you learn about him?
I would say my experiences and my lessons have been very similar to Sean's. Mr. Trump is a busy man and doesn't have time to micromanage. So as long as things are being accomplished according to expectations, then it's always made for a very good working relationship for me with Mr. Trump. Like Sean, I'll admit that I was a bit intimidated on my first encounter with him, but having been on the show and then, of course, having had the opportunity to work with him more closely since the show, those barriers have been broken down, and it's more of a productive working relationship.
What was he like when the cameras were not rolling? Sean?
It's not like he's got some kind of character that he puts on just for the camera. Mr. Trump is Mr. Trump. He maybe doesn't try to intimidate you in that kind of boardroom setting as much when the cameras are rolling. You're like, occasionally say, hey, how you guys doing? You know, they treating you well? You eating okay? Et cetera, but at the same time, even when the cameras aren't rolling, it's still a job interview. You're still being judged 24/7. So it doesn't ever get to a stage where you're kind of like, oh, I'm out of character now. It's a reality show, and it's all very real. So Mr. Trump doesn't go in and out of character. He is pretty much how he is. You see him on the camera. Only he might say something like, hey, guys, you know, you're doing well, you know, keep up the good work, but no more other than that.
And Randall, Sean just mentioned the 24/7 job interview. How present was that when you were on the program? Because I guess even when you're sitting there having breakfast or doing whatever, there's always the sense that the cameras might be recording you and you might be finished because of something you say.
Well, it's not even the sense that the cameras might be recording you. It is the reality that the cameras are always recording you. It's sometimes deceiving to the viewing audience because, you know, the experience of a week-long task is windowed down to all of 40 minutes. But those cameras are literally there 24/7. When you wake up, they're there. When you go to bed, they're there. And all points in between. And also, you know, for me, it was something I was mindful of from the beginning until the end, that I certainly wanted to compete and to win, but to also, have a performance and, you might say, a presentation that I could be proud of, that I could look back when the show was edited and say that I was able to represent myself, accurately, and that my work ethic and my values were able to come through on the show.
So you felt you were fairly treated as the show was being edited?
Generally, yes. And you might find this ironic, but believe it or not, I actually thought that I came across as being nicer on the show than I actually am in real life. I had a lot of real nice moments that made it on the show for me. So I think people think I'm really nice.
Yeah, well, people don't realize that Rand is actually a really horrible guy. He's not nice at all.
Oh, dear. Sean, what about you?
The nicest guy. You know what? A bit of a mix of everything. I remember seeing, I think it was episode 2, and they had a close-up of me eating cornflakes at 6 o'clock in the morning with a big spot on the side of my cheek and shaving foam down my neck. It was like a really unflattering shot. So that just tells you the cameras don't ever stop rolling. You know what? Like Randall says, if you have like maybe 20 cameras going on over a period of, say, whatever that task is, how many days that task goes on for, and they whittle it down to 42 minutes, there's so much that they can do. But overall, it was a fair representation, I feel. You know, I mean, they have to choose selectively, you know, to put together to represent what happened. But, you know, it's fairly representative.
Okay. My guests are Sean Yazbek and Randall Pinkett. They're both businessmen and former winners of The Apprentice. They're also spokesmen for the Trump Institute, which is giving business seminars in Stockton and Sacramento over the next few days. Tell us, what actually happens once you win The Apprentice? Because the idea behind the show is that the winner is going to go work for Donald Trump. Is that true? Do you actually really go and work for Donald Trump? Randall, you were the season 4 winner. What happened to you with Donald Trump after the show was over?
Well, as I'm sure was the case for Sean, the first weeks, if not the first few months, was literally nonstop media coverage, interviews and the like. Once that died down, it was really back to reality, and I did indeed begin my assignment, which was in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and was managing a renovation project for Mr. Trump. And having finished that year, I've now extended my relationship with him here into 2007, along with Sean as a spokesperson for the Trump Institute and also as faculty at Trump University. So it is very real, and if it weren't real, I wouldn't be able to say that the relationship it has continued, but it's very substantive, and it's been very beneficial, and it's been actually more than I had anticipated when I first signed up.
Okay, and Sean?
Yeah, I mean, much the same. I remember Mr. Trump actually telling me to go and take a week off first, and we shot off for 1 week. And actually, whilst I went off to take some rest and recreation for that week, because it was pretty crazy leading up to that, to the final, I was on the phone every day doing radio interviews and whatnot. And when I came back, again, it's a lot of juggling the media and the business. I was trying very hard to put as much effort as I could into performing very well, you know, in the offices up in New York. But there's only so much you can do when you're doing a lot of the media. And as the weeks go by, you know, the media thing, you know, kind of like dies down somewhat, and you're able to concentrate more on the work. And the work is very real. What I did when I was up there is I tried to talk and interact with as many people in the Trump organization as possible, just to get an understanding of how everything works. And, you know, be lucky with any organization, before you know it, you're up and running.
Sean, did you come to the United States to compete in The Apprentice, or were you already here?
No, I've actually already here. A lot of people think I just got off a plane and came straight to New York for the Trump to The Apprentice. I'd actually been out here for six years, And I'd long been one of those armchair watchers, you know, armchair project managers watching the show. Saying, oh, I could do that. I remember watching Randall thinking, no, he's the man, but I could do it, I could do that. And then I got my green card. And then within a couple of weeks, because once I became a permanent resident, I was allowed to actually apply for the show. So I went on and applied.
And Randall, I think the main question people have for you who saw you on TV is, how did you manage to get 5 academic degrees, including degrees from Rutgers, Oxford, and MIT?
Well, it's definitely a popular question. Interestingly, it was not by design necessarily, but believe it or not, somewhat by circumstance. I was envisioning pursuing a PhD during my years in college, and took a positive detour, and I say very positive detour, to receive the Rhodes Scholarship and then study at Oxford. But it did indeed take me off the path that I had already charted. So I took the 2 years to study in England and then came back to the States to finish my doctoral studies. And in the process of doing so, was able to pick up an MBA without losing any time. So the goal was always the PhD, and the Rhodes Scholarship was just a wonderful blessing to add icing on the cake.
Now, as regards the Trump Institute, which is going to be in Stockton and Sacramento, are either of you two or even Donald Trump going to be there?
No, we're not going to be there. People that will be there, the people that work with Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization, in much the same way that, you know, Randall has, like, more degrees than you could possibly imagine. I've got my measly 1 degree. But, you know, himself with some very, very talented businessmen, lawyers, accountants, the best that you can possibly find. And it is these people that essentially that will be doing the seminar in Sacramento. We've had upwards of 500,000 people attending these seminars. These are in-person seminars held up and down the country. And I think that the main thing that people need to remember is that they're absolutely free.
How could Donald Trump be a billionaire with giving free seminars?
Well, that's the fact. He is a billionaire. That's why he can do it. And Mr. Trump, in a way, is giving back, like, you know, to the community in much the same way that Randall and I are learning from him, you know, as a mentor. He's allowing, you know, his experiences of creating wealth, i.e. owning your own business, investing in real estate, allowing people to come along to these seminars and find out how they can do it for themselves.
But is there some other kind of sales that goes on at the end of the seminar?
Certainly, I think there's opportunities to sign up for others if you want to, but if you just go to the seminar itself, there's all kinds of things that you'll come away with, like knowledge-wise. Mm-hmm. The kind of things you're going to learn when you go there are how to get cash back when you buy your property, how to jumpstart your business by using other people's money, how to make money in the real estate market when the market's taking a downturn. There's all kinds of things which, you know, tools which Mr. Trump uses to make money. And it doesn't matter what kind of level of business experience that you have. There's something there pretty much, I think, for everyone. So long as you're hungry and you want to achieve and you are driven, there'll be something pretty much for everyone to learn from.
Now, on the Trump Institute website, there's an article that I saw written by a professor at City College of New York titled Submerge Your Ego. And among other tips, it suggests you spend less time reading your press clippings. Now, I have to say, anyone who's familiar with Donald Trump would find this advice a little surprising, given Mr. Trump's approach to life. Is that something Mr. Trump endorses, Sean?
I know Mr. Trump is Mr. Trump. He wouldn't be anyone else. I mean, he is who he is, and he's gotten where he is by being the way he is. I mean, he says what he wants to say, and certainly with recent feuds going on in the media, he's not scared to say what he wants to say. You know, if somebody speaks about him in the press, he's the first person to stand up and say something about it. You know, he's that kind of guy. He's very strong. He's intelligently assertive, he's almost aggressive, but that's why he's become a billionaire, and that's why he's, the biggest icon in the world in regards to business.
And finally, Sean, you're a boardroom advisor in the current season of The Apprentice. What's it like being on the other side?
A lot of fun. I enjoy that so much. I tell you what, when we were filming the first show that I was on when I was filming it, I actually felt nauseous. I don't know, Randall, if you got this. When you watch or when I started watching the show, or even when I was filming on the new season, I got this nauseous feeling. It's like, because all the cameras on it, I felt like I was on the task myself. Like, oh gosh, the cameras are running. We've got 2 hours, and then I had to remind myself that I'm not being judged. I'm the judge. So it was kind of an eerie situation. But being on the other side of the boardroom table, it was good. I didn't hammer the guys as much as possible as like past judges maybe have, because I felt like you can get more out of them if you just let them talk. You know, I want to hear what they have to say, as opposed to just beating them for the sake of beating them. But you know, Randall's on this weekend on Sunday night. Randall.
Yeah, absolutely, and I would preface my comments by saying I thought Sean did an excellent job for the two episodes that he's appeared already. You know, it was great to see him on the other side of the boardroom table. He looked a lot more relaxed in that chair than when he was in the hot seat for the few times that he was there during his season. And for me, you know, my episode will air on Sunday, but it was a great opportunity just to be back, you know, in the throes of the show and seeing a new crop of entrepreneurs vying for the opportunity that Sean and I competed for. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different perspective, and it gave me an even fuller appreciation for what I had gone through.
Sean Yazbek and Randall Pinkett, businessmen, former winners of The Apprentice, and they're also spokesmen for the Trump Institute, which is giving business seminars in this area over the next few days. Sean and Randall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you. Much appreciated.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a local food blogger is getting national buzz. You'll meet writer Elise Bauer when we return. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and next time in Insight, a honeybee shortage may cause headaches for California almond growers. Bee experts and farmers will tell you about this potential pollination crisis. Plus, you'll meet psychologist and author Maria Nemeth. Her new book is about mastering life's energies. A recent story in the Wall Street Journal told about a new kind of website that's turning people into hidden influencers, shaping what we read, watch, and buy. That's a quote from the subheading. The article was headlined, "The Wizards of Buzz." It was about so-called social bookmarking websites like Delicious, Dig, and Reddit. Users dig up interesting content online, other users vote on it, and the most popular stuff gets moved up the hierarchy and can tick off. One of those so-called influencers, that is, people who are making a particular impact, is a Carmichael woman called Elise Bauer. She was profiled in the Wall Street Journal story. As well as being on Delicious, Elise also has her own popular food blog. She's been doing it for about 5 years, and it's gotten favorable media coverage, including a listing in Time magazine as one of the 50 coolest sites of 2006. The blog is called Simply Recipes. Elise Bauer is in our studio. Elise, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're not a professional chef. How did you get started writing a food blog?
Oh, that's a great question. I am not. I'm so far from being a professional chef, it isn't even funny. Fortunately, however, I grew up with two parents who both loved to cook. And I moved away from home. I went off and had my professional life. I was a very busy Silicon Valley executive, single. I did take out almost every night. And when I hit my 40s, I realized I really didn't know anything about cooking other than what I remembered from living at home in high school. And so I started calling my parents and writing down the recipes and putting them on my website. I had a website at the time. And then when blogging came out, blogging allows for very easy publishing of websites. I turned my recipe collection into a blog. And a few years ago, I moved back to Sacramento, so now I spend a lot of time with my parents, and we cook a lot together. We're always researching recipes, and the blog has just been growing organically since then. And so in a way, I have been using the blog to learn how to cook for my parents.
What exactly was it that got you back into, or really got you into cooking? Was there a particular event or a recipe or a dinner or something like that that got you, that sparked the interest? Or was it maybe a gradual process?
I think it was a gradual process, but it was also cooking a lot of things that really turned out horribly and wanting to know why. I realized that I didn't know the most basic things. Like, I didn't know how to cut up a chicken. Now, my parents, who were both in their 70s, and my dad especially, who was raised in the Depression, but actually both of them, they can, if I brought home a live chicken, they'd be able to kill it, pluck it, gut it, cook it, cut it up. They would know how to do everything. Because in my parents' generation, people knew how to do those things. My dad, growing up in Minnesota in the 30s, he would go into the forest and shoot squirrels and bring them home. And his mother would then make squirrel stew with those squirrels. And we have become so completely disconnected from where our food comes from. It's amazing. So for me, I found it just appalling that I had made it so far in this life and did not know the most basic things about how to put good food together. So for me, that was more of a sense of pride. I really like eating well. I like eating from whole ingredients or food made from whole foods, whole ingredients. None of the packaged stuff. Can't stand that. But I didn't know how to do it. So that's really what's been motivating me all along.
The squirrel stew on your website?
No, it's not. Though out in Carmichael, we live in an old walnut orchard, and we certainly have plenty of opportunities. But no, no squirrel stew on the site.
What kind of food did you grow up with?
Meatloaf, liver and onions, pot roast, roast beef, coleslaw, peas. Let's see. Tuna macaroni salad.
Yeah.
Real regular comfort food. I have four younger brothers and a younger sister. We had a very big family, and my dad was a teacher, so we're big family on a budget, and we made the kinds of foods that could feed the family well and healthfully, but do it economically.
I got the sense from looking at Simply Recipes that you like comfort food.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. And the food that's on the site is the food that we eat. We don't really, once in a while we'll take the time and make a complicated recipe because it just sounds so intriguing. For example, there's a recipe on the site, the lasagna bolognese, which was actually a recipe that was suggested by one of our readers. He wrote down this recipe in one of the comments, and it sounded so good we had to try it. Well, to make a very good lasagna bolognese, you have to cook that sauce for several hours. But I tell you, this recipe is worth it. It's out of this world. It's absolutely out of this world. And so we have some recipes like that, yeah, they take a lot of time, but man, they are so worth doing. But we don't want to work really hard at cooking something and then find it wasn't worth the effort. So there are lots of great recipes out there. A lot of them aren't worth the effort. We would rather have a great recipe that we can get done in a reasonable amount of time using ingredients that we can easily find. Or if we're going to make something a little bit more complicated, we want to make sure it's worth the effort.
Sounds like your parents are very active participants in Simply Recipes.
Very active. Every day the discussion goes, all right, well, what do we need to, what should we be cooking now? Oh, let me see. In fact, it was just last week, or was it a few days ago, my dad had made some spinach for dinner, and it was so good. And I looked at that spinach, and I thought, I actually don't think this is on the site, and we have this at least once a week. And it's just one of those things that we have every week. It's fabulous. Dad's in charge of cooking the spinach. He does a great job. And so I made him the next day. I went shopping with him. We bought more spinach. I made him cook the spinach for me so I could document it and take pictures of it. I think he probably does around half the cooking on the site.
My guest is Elise Bauer. She's a food blogger who is getting national attention. Her blog is called Simply Recipes. She lives in Carmichael, spent years living in the Bay Area as a business consultant. She's also on the social bookmarking website Delicious, which was written about recently in the Wall Street Journal, and Elise was profiled in that Wall Street Journal article. And on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, there's a link to Simply Recipes and to Delicious. What did your parents make about sharing old family treasured recipes on the internet? I guess some people could get a little possessive about such things.
Yeah, I think my mom initially said, well, but this is my recipe. I said, Mom, if you share your recipes with the world, we will all eat better. Please think of this as a public service. And as she says it, I can be quite persuasive. So now they have no problem at all. In fact, we actively look for great recipes that we can share with everyone, because I believe, and we really believe, that the more that people cook, and the better they cook, the better we all eat.
You've been written up successfully. You've gotten favorable write-ups in a lot of big national media, Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, and you've also been in major newspapers elsewhere. How do you manage to get this attention to your blog? Because there are millions of blogs in the world.
I think one of the reasons is that my blog is very big. So there are millions of blogs in the world, but not all of them have the readership that mine has. So I have probably between 40,000 and 50,000 people a day coming to read Simply Recipes.
My goodness.
Over a million people a month. And that is that has to do with lots of things. But one of the things is that I write about foods that people like to eat. So when they do a search on Google, they're more likely to find something that I've written because they're looking for it in the first place.
A million people a month. Does that get scary? Does it start to feel demanding?
Sometimes it does. And I have internal practice of the minute it starts to feel I'm aggravated or it feels demanding, I take a step back and realize that my happiness comes first. I do this for my joy and an expression of what I like to do, and it shouldn't be running my life. One of the things that has become more that's become more true over the years, when I first started, it was just really recipes for me to remember and maybe my siblings and my close friends. And now that audience has grown so much, I put a recipe up there, and that day, dozens of people will try the recipe. So I'll get feedback right away. And sometimes if I've made a typo on the recipe, it can be pretty horrifying to realize that someone just spent a bunch of time and money to make something and they messed it up because I had a typo. So the thing that makes me want to pull out my hair is when I make a mistake on a recipe.
Do you think about that when you post a recipe that hundreds and maybe even more than hundreds of people are going to try it out themselves?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think about them all baking or frying at the same time?
Mm-hmm. And I hear back from them. And one of the things that's been so helpful for me is that not only do the readers of Simply Recipes try out the recipes, but they'll leave in the comments their experience of the recipe and how they changed it. Most people who are scratch cooks, we rarely follow a recipe to the letter. We look at a recipe and think, well, I think I don't have parsley on hand, so I will use something else. Or I don't have canned tomatoes, I have fresh. We tend to use a lot of ingredients that are in hand and use a recipe as a guideline, which for the most part is how recipes should be used as guidelines. So what I love is hearing back from readers who tweaked the recipe a little bit, added something, subtracted something, and it turned out wonderfully for them, because then I learn, or maybe it didn't turn out well for them, and I learned something else there too. So we're all learning as we're trying out these recipes.
Why should someone buy a cookbook when you have free of charge all your massive number of recipes up on your website?
Well, I have maybe 500 or 600 recipes on the site, and I
own more than most books could have.
More than most books, but not as many as the Joy of Cooking's got 4,000 recipes.
Yes.
So there, I've got probably 30 or 40 cookbooks, and I'm referring them to them all the time. The websites are very convenient for searching for recipes, for finding them, for bookmarking your favorite recipes, and cookbooks have their own appeal. I love to open up a cookbook and to read what the author is writing about these recipes, in the kitchen, it's pretty easy to have a cookbook open. You can write notes in it. Not that many people have their computers in their kitchen, but what we do is we'll print out a recipe online and then work with it from that in the kitchen.
Do you think blogs like yours will eventually overtake cookbooks?
Maybe. I don't know. I think part of it depends on the economics of blogging and the economics of print publishing. So print cookbooks are expensive to produce and to distribute and to photograph. And with digital photography, with web publishing, all of those costs of distribution, there are no printing costs and the cost of distribution are none. So the cost is radically lower to publish recipes when you're publishing them online.
But there's still your time and expertise.
Right.
So do you make money out of the Simply Recipes blog? Are you trying to?
I am trying to. Yeah. And I do. And I have advertising on the site, and that helps support the cost of the site. So,
and do you run that aspect of it yourself?
I run everything myself. Yeah, except for Dad does a lot of the cooking. And Mom does some cooking too, though. I think after, I don't know, how she's in her 70s now, and they've been married almost 50 years. So after almost 50 years of cooking, family meals, she's very content to step back and let Dad cook more.
What's your favorite recipe on Simply Recipes?
My mom's cheese enchiladas recipe.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Easy to make, really delicious.
Yeah.
Very Tex-Mex-ish. It's not sort of the kind of enchiladas you'd get if you went to Mexico, but it's where my mom grew up in Tucson, and that was her mom's recipe. It's fabulous.
And when we started talking, you said that when you were really heavily into your consulting career in the Bay Area, you ate out every night. Do you still eat out?
Rarely. Rarely.
How does the eating out food taste nowadays, now that you're so dedicated to making your own food and being heavily invested in that?
I go to Biba's. She's fabulous.
That's not bad.
Or Lemongrass. I pick, or Selin's. I mean, I pick the places where I know I'm going to get great food.
Yeah. Well, Elise, it was a real pleasure meeting you. I appreciate you coming in today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Elise Bauer, food blogger. She's getting national attention. Her blog is called Simply Recipes, and you can find a link to that, as well as Delicious, the bookmarking website where Elise also has a presence. You can find them both at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the Hammond organ of Booker T. Jones give a soulful groove to the 60s hits of Booker T. and the MGs. With a local concert coming up, it's Booker T. Jones and his timeless music when we return. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Green Onions is one of the timeless songs of both soul and rock. Hard to believe it's 45 years old. It's the defining song of the band Booker T and the MGs, but not their only great one. Other hits included Hip Hugger, Soul Limbo, and Time is Tight. The band won a Lifetime Grammy Award last month. Booker T himself, Booker T. Jones, has had a successful career outside the band too, working as a producer, songwriter, and musician with some of the biggest names in popular music, artists like Otis Redding, Willie Nelson, Albert King, and Neil Young. Booker T. Jones plays Grass Valley this weekend with a concert at the Center for the Arts. He joins us. Booker T. Jones, welcome to Insight.
Hello, Jeffrey.
You know, I can't imagine how many times you've played and heard Green Onions. How does it sound to you today?
Oh, I just enjoyed it just now when I heard you play it.
Do you remember when creating the song?
Absolutely.
Tell us how it happened. Did you and the band realize how powerful this song would be?
Absolutely not, because the entire creation of it happened by happenstance, by mistake. We were at the studio that day as session musicians to play a background session for an artist that didn't show up.
Really?
We didn't have any studio time planned that day. And so we just made use of the time and recorded a blues song that I've been playing in the clubs called Behave Yourself. And the engineer owner, Jim Stewart, liked it so much, he thought, well, that's something that maybe we ought to try to put it out as a single. So we needed a B-side for that blues, and we recorded Green Onions for the B-side.
And when did it become known as Green Onions?
Well, that was the name we put on the record when we put it out. Yeah, it was Green Onions. Yeah, we called it Funky Onions at first, and then it just became Green Onions, which was a more acceptable title. Yeah.
Now, you got started in professional music when you were 16, is that right, playing saxophone?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
You were a song by Rufus and Carla Thomas.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I borrowed the baritone sax from the high school band room, and my friend David Porter drove me over and took me out of class and drove me over to Stax Records in the afternoon, and I got through the door to the recording studio and got in there and was able to let them know that I played piano and was able to get a job there.
Well, you are most famous as a musician for playing the Hammond organ and the piano. How did you come to get started by playing a saxophone?
Well, I started playing clarinet was my first real musical instrument when I was 10 years old, in fourth grade. And I always played horns. So I always played clarinet and oboe, trombone. I got my degree from Indiana University playing trombone. The piano was something I took up later, classical piano, and the organ after that. But I always considered myself an instrumentalist, playing horn.
Now, you met the Booker T and the MGs guitarist Steve Cropper in a record store, is that right?
That's right, uh-huh.
He was working there.
Yeah, it was Satellite Records in Memphis, the front to the Capitol Theater. They had turned the concessions area into a record store.
Were you looking for a guitarist at that time?
Absolutely not. No, Steve Cropper was the clerk who was allowing me to listen to the records, as a high school kid. In those days, you could go in and, you'd play a little bit of a record and decided if you wanted to buy it. They had turntables set up, and Cropper was working there.
How important is that interplay between the organ and the guitar to the sound of the Booker T and the MGs?
That was pretty crucial, the interplay between these two instruments. I think it kept it from being boring, and that was the crux of the matter there.
Yeah. Well, we have another Booker T and the MGs song lined up here. It's Soul Limbo. Let's hear a little bit of it, and then we'll talk about it. Booker T, I grew up in the United Kingdom, and there, this music is the theme music for the cricket coverage on the BBC. And when I was a kid, I just assumed the people that made this were guys from Jamaica or somewhere like that. Did Booker T and the MGs get this authentic limbo sound?
Well, that was the influence, was the Jamaican influence. That was a departure. We were trying to make a departure from our regular sound, and the drummer, Al Jackson, he always loved that Jamaican sound. It was our attempt to make a Jamaican sounding song. Well, I'm glad you thought that it was originally from there.
It sounds like a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's a fun song. Yeah.
Now you have You still play, Booker T and the MGs still exist, but you also have your own Booker T. Jones band. What's the difference between the two today? What do you play in one and what do you play in the other?
Well, with the Booker T and the MGs, we play only instrumentals. But with the Booker T. Jones band, I expand some. I play some jazz, and I play some of my favorite Stax hits, and I sing with the Booker T. Jones band. And I also do some new originals. But Booker T and the MGs pretty much sticks to the original songs that we did in the early 60s.
Now, your gig in Grass Valley is the Booker T. Jones band.
That's right. Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay. How many of the Booker T and the MGs songs do you play in concert with the Booker T. Jones band?
Well, we always play Green Onions, and usually we play Soul Limbo, and sometimes Hang 'em High or Hip Hover or Time is Tight.
Well, you know, we have Time is Tight lined up. Let's listen to a bit of that.
Okay.
Now, Booker T, as well as the band having its own success in its own right, the band also was basically the house band for Stax Records in Memphis. How did you come to be both a house band, you know, basically playing for all kinds of musicians, but also being a star name band in your own right?
Well, our original job was as house band. We always were the session group there at Stax. That was our original occupation. And it just so happened that we recorded this Green Onions and put it out. Every now and then we would put out instrumental records. But our main occupation there was to come and play sessions behind, you know, Otis Redding or Carla Thomas or Sam and Dave or whoever the artists were that were coming in the studio at the time.
Now, the Stax Records sound, then, I guess, an important part of it is Booker T and the MGs, since you were the band for so many of the great artists that played there.
Yes, we played behind most of the artists that came through Stax. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was an important role that you and the others played. Did the record label see this is the kind of sound they wanted, or did they just rely on you guys to come up with a sound that would define the label?
Well, it was pretty intimate, yes. We were consciously trying to make our sound simple and soulful, and that was what the label wanted us to stick to that formula pretty much, yes.
Now, after you left Stax Records, you had a successful career, and still do, producing, arranging, playing with other musicians. And we're going to listen to some of that work here. We'll start with Ain't No Sunshine by Bill Withers. Tell us what your role was in this record.
I had moved to California, and I had a ranch in Malibu at the time, and a friend of mine knew Bill Withers, who at the time was working in Inglewood. He was building airplane toilets, and he was a songwriter, and this friend had him come over to sing some of his songs for me to see what he thought. And I loved those songs and, you know, right away arranged to get into the studio to record him.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away,
such a beautiful song. How do you approach taking a song that is at least on the surface simple and beautiful, and you know, take advantage of that and make it what it can be, but without doing too much?
Well, our approach there was that was Bill with his acoustic guitar, and he was just kind of stomping on a wooden box with his foot there. And I just wrote string arrangements for a small group, about 16 strings, and kept it pretty sparse. And so, the beauty was in the simplicity there.
Does it still sound good to you?
Oh, I love it, yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's great to hear it again. Yeah.
My guest is Booker T. Jones, legendary soul musician, songwriter, and producer. He was the leader of the band Booker T. and the MGs, and he's worked in various ways with many other great artists. And he and his band play the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley tomorrow evening. Another artist you worked with, and this one might come as a surprise to some people, was Willie Nelson. How did you come to work with Willie Nelson?
I met Willie when I was living in Malibu on the beach. And Willie and his wife rented the apartment beneath mine there, and I saw him walking down the beach one day and went out to meet him. And we started playing together, you know, on the deck at night, and we just started jamming on various songs that we both really loved, and we ended up in the studio.
And that became the album Stardust, which is really a collection of great pop songs from the 30s, 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of them is Georgia on My Mind. Well, let's hear a bit of it.
Georgia. Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Georgia.
Is that you playing the piano, Booker?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was Willie Nelson like to work with?
Well, it was very easy to work with. We had a great time. Very professional and very fast in the studio.
Yeah.
Another.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, Willie's a consummate musician. You know, he's a real professional.
Now you also. I've written many songs, and one of them is a real classic, Born Under a Bad Sign, by Albert King. Now, you played on the Albert King's version, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I played piano.
You played piano on that. And, well, let's hear it.
You know I wouldn't have no luck at all.
Did you write this song for Albert
King?
Yes.
Yes, I did, with my partner William Bell. William wrote the lyrics and I wrote the music.
And then Cream went on to do a version of it as well. What did you make of that?
Oh, I liked it. I liked that band.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker. Yeah, that's a good band.
Yeah. Well, Booker T, you've played... Your career has extended over decades. You've done a lot of amazing things. What's the highlight of your career, would you say, to date?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, I would have to say receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Recording Association, the Recording Academy.
Just last month?
Yes, that's the... although it wasn't a musical experience, it was just because it came from my peers. It just meant so much to me, and it just... it gave my life, you know, such a validation, and it just made me feel good.
And do you still enjoy playing live?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that's the best.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Booker T. Jones, it was a real pleasure talking with you this afternoon.
And good talking to you, Jeffrey. I'm looking forward to going up to Grass Valley. You know, some nice, crisp weather up there. It's been about 22 years since I was in Grass Valley.
Is that right? Well, I'm sure they'll welcome you back.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Booker T. Jones, a legendary soul musician. He and his band, the Booker T. Jones Band, play at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley tomorrow evening. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're going to go out with some more Booker T. and the MGs, more of Soul Limbo. Coming up on the KXJZ station, Sierra Leone was beginning to control a disease that blinds people. Then civil war disrupted public health efforts. Now many people are losing their eyesight. That story in the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producer was Robin Souza. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Acting assistant producer is Natalie Breen. And senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. Honeybee shortage may cause headaches for California almond growers. Next time in Insight, bee experts and farmers tell you about this potential pollination crisis. Plus, you'll meet psychologist and author Maria Nemeth. Her new book is about mastering life's energies. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tuesday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.